Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of April. First hour of our program today, we have a couple guests and we'll be taking on a wide range of topics. Milton Coleman is with us the first half hour of our program. He's going to be receiving a very high honor this Saturday. The Milwaukee Press Club at their Gridiron Awards dinner will give him the 2007 Sacred Cat Award. He is from Milwaukee. He is now deputy managing editor of the Washington Post. He joined the paper in 1976 as a reporter on the Metropolitan staff. Later in the District of Columbia in 1980, he became city editor. He moved to the National News staff. In 84, he covered the presidential campaign, Congress, state and local governments. And in July of 96, he was promoted to his current position as deputy managing editor, where he does all kinds of things. Keeps an eye on coverage, helps direct the coverage. He, as I said, grew up in Milwaukee, and he received a scholarship to attend the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which he said was a key turning point in his life. He said, "I don't know what I would have done without that scholarship," which I remember correctly was $128, get that, a semester. When all was said and done, that was my ticket to ride. It was like a handshake to me. It said to me, "I'm a scholar." So we'll talk about education and about newspapers and media this first part of the program. And we'll also be looking at the House vote on Iraq, which is the big news story of the day. A little bit later, we'll have a law professor from Duke University who will look at what the House has done, what the Senate is debating, what powers Congress has, what powers the president has when it comes to conducting war. And we'll welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Milton Coleman, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
And congratulations on the award. It's really quite a prestigious award.
Thank you very much. I feel very humbled and very honored by it, and at the same time very thankful for all the people who had so much to do with the successes I've been blessed to have.
You've written about this and talked about it, the people in your life who took chances on you, and if we're lucky in life, we do have people who take chances on us and help us achieve so many things in our lives, right? Who took a chance on you? Who took a chance on you in Milwaukee?
Well, as far as there were a lot of people in high school who took chances on me. I had very good teachers, and I think during the time that I was in high school, the band director at Lincoln High School, Ronald E. Villers, just sort of became a mentor to me. I entered college wanting to be a high school band director, and of course, this followed many people who took chances, including my parents and members of my family who sacrificed for me. Getting into the news business, I really owe the start of my career to people at the Milwaukee Courier, to Walter Jones, who was the editor then, to Gerald Jones, who was, I guess until recently, the publisher, who I believe is still the owner, and to a wonderful city editor named Carol Malone, all of whom took a chance on someone who had not studied journalism in college, had not worked at any establishment newspapers, and who thought he could write and thought he could report. And I learned an awful lot from them. They all took chances on me.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? You wanted to be a band director, and now you're directing people in their writing.
Yes, sometimes it's like a band. I won't say what kind of band.
I'll bet it's like a band. Tell me about some of these interesting experiences. I was digging through some old material about you, because I'm sure that these were formative events. A piece you wrote a couple years ago, twice before your 25th birthday, you spent the night in jail. Once because of an open housing demonstration. I think people forget that history in Milwaukee. And the second was a newspaper thing. You want to start with a newspaper thing?
Oh, yes. I was working for the Courier, and I did a lot of street reporting, and I would sometimes on weekends I had the Courier's van, and I would turn on the police radio and follow police calls because there was at that time a concern in the community that there were issues of police brutality. And at one point, I believe it was on Center Street early in the morning, I noticed the police making an arrest, and I went to photograph the arrest. I think it was a minor arrest or whatever, and the officer in charge told me when I snapped the first picture that I could not take any pictures. Well, of course, being a young reporter and being very energetic And quite honestly, a bit defiant, I immediately snapped another picture.
Of course.
And then I was arrested. And I was originally charged with obstructing an officer, which I believe is a felony. That charge was later reduced to interfering with an arrest. And I was ultimately acquitted of the charge.
Mm-hmm. So you learned a lesson, and you say it's a lesson that's still valid.
I think the lesson there that still remains with me is part of the mission that we have as reporters. We do go into this business to try to unearth information that we believe can right wrongs, that can help society.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I felt at the time I was doing the right thing, and I felt that that was a role that the press plays.
Yeah. Tell me about the efforts that you've led to improve coverage of minorities for the Post. I know you've done that with Latinos, and I want to dovetail on that. Some interesting things that were said about this whole Don Imus firing, that we perhaps have reached a point nowhere near where we ought to be, where we have enough minorities in powerful positions in newsrooms at CBS, at the Washington Post, at the New York Times, at other places, that you can no longer get away with this and be a hotshot radio news jockey, or you can't. It's because of people like you who are in very large decision-making capacities now at big places.
Well, I think that's a little more flattering than it should be. I think if you would ask many of the people who are in the business, many of the journalists of color, there are some of us who are in relatively high positions. There are many places where we are not.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was important in the Don Imus situation was that the employees of CBS and the employees of NBC, no matter what their ranks, I gather, many of them employees of color, and I also understand women, came forward and spoke truth to power and said that, look, this is something that I don't feel very good about being affiliated with this station or with this network or with this company if that kind of speech is going to go on. We're all in favor of freedom of speech, but every news organization has to decide where it will come down in terms of what it allows people to say, and obviously it's the financial supporters of those news organizations have a right to feel the same way. I think what was one of the most important aspects of the Imus situation was that these journalists of color and these women were able to speak up and were listened to.
Yes.
Because everyone feels that many of us got into this business to change it, and we want to find ways to have some influence on the content. And I think that's what was important in the Imus situation. Now, it is true, as you said, and it's been true for many years, that most news organizations do not get into trouble for what they report. What we tend to get into trouble for is what we do not report. We tend to be criticized for not offering balanced pictures, for not offering a portrait of this community that is just not all negative, that gives the other sides of the story. It's not that people are saying they don't want to hear anything negative, but people are wondering whether or not the stories that we present of their particular communities, the images that we present, are indeed enough of a totality as to reflect all the aspects, or many aspects, or certainly the good and the bad of those communities.
Yeah, so how do you determine the totality?
You determine it a lot of times by the feedback that you get.
I see.
And you have to try to remain in touch with the communities that you cover. Sometimes we can really get out of touch, and we can be in our own little ivory towers and thinking that we're doing the greatest thing to help humanity. And in fact, we may be distorting the pictures of the realities. We may not be able to understand them if we don't have people who are familiar with those cultures. You know, many of us who came into the business in the 60s and the 70s recognized that the news media had, in fact, been cited in the Kerner Commission report when it talked about this was a nation separate and unequal, two separate nations. It partially blamed the news media for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a rush of us who came into the media, into so-called mainstream media, prepared to alter the story that was being told of our communities by bringing our knowledge of those communities and building upon that. And I think that's why we need diversity in the news business. And then those voices have to be listened to. We started a program in Spanish language instruction in our newsroom because, as one of my colleagues noted, most of the people in those communities speak Spanish, and if we don't speak Spanish as well, those are voices we'll never hear.
Yeah, interesting. You talked about speaking truth to power, Milton, earlier. Is that a guiding philosophy for you? Is that why you do what you do, to speak truth to power?
Well, I'm now sort of in an awkward position where I am power, but I try to, you know, when I joined the staff of the Milwaukee Courier in 1969, I did so believing that if I did my job properly, the people in my community, the people in the black community in Milwaukee, would have better information upon which to make the decisions that affect their lives. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that, though I have a much broader stage that I must play on now. But I still believe that's what we need to do. It's a sometimes common slogan, so to speak. I can't get the right word now. Adage. It's a sometimes common adage that we in the news business are in this business to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I think that is true to a certain degree, that we do want to try to say those things which help people, and a lot of us a lot of us root for the underdog, a lot of us pull for the underdog, mm-hmm. But we also have a greater constitutionally inscribed role, which is to be a free and independent press, and to hold everyone accountable, to hold the government accountable, to hold leaders accountable, and even to hold ourselves accountable. So I think that is part of what we do, and we're very fortunate to be in that situation. I've spent a lot of time working with the Inter-American Press Association, which represents newspapers in Latin America. In Latin America, there are very difficult times because they do not have the same freedom of the press that we do, and people often who write articles that are not liked by those in power are threatened and sometimes even killed. Mm-hmm. And so we really have to cherish this role. It's a wonderful right that we have. At the same time, we have obligations and responsibilities.
The press has been criticized, as you well know, Milton, for not really doing its job, not holding the powers that be accountable when it came to taking this nation to war, and now it goes on and on and on, and we got this fight going on between Congress and the president. Did the media fall down on the job there? Did you not dig enough?
I'm not so sure. The question was whether we dug enough versus whether we gave enough prominent play to the stories that were critical and the stories that raised doubts about the wisdom of invading Iraq. It was clear to me, as someone in Washington in the walk-up to that war, that there was tremendous opposition within the government, that there were a lot of stories coming out of the Pentagon that were raising doubts about the wisdom of the path that was to be pursued. Many news organizations, ourselves included, wrote these stories. These stories were published. These stories were aired on television. The problem oftentimes was that they were not given the same sort of presentation. They were not given the same prominence that was given to reports on the other side. And I think that people therein felt that we were a little bit asleep at the switch.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you now see news organizations trying in earnest to make sure that we are not accused of the same thing in what some believe is a walk-up to some sort of action against Iran. And I think you've seen a lot of stories of people sort of looking back in hindsight and saying, we're not going to let that happen to us again.
Mm-hmm. Milton Coleman is our guest, deputy managing editor of The Washington Post. And he's going to be honored this Saturday by the Milwaukee Press Club at the Gridiron Dinner, receiving the 2007 Sacred Cat Award. He is from Milwaukee, went to Milwaukee Public Schools, won a scholarship to attend the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and he is now, as I said, deputy managing editor. There are a number of areas we're talking about with him. Minorities in the newsroom, what difference that makes, covering minority communities. We're looking at how the press holds those in power accountable, when they do a great job on that, when they don't. And we're just welcoming phone calls, so give us a ring. If you'd like to speak with Milton, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I was struck yesterday when we were speaking with Dirk Halstead, the photographer for 50 years, who covered the White House, who was talking about the press, and he said that he didn't think there would be newspapers 5 years, and maybe that's too long a period of time. That's all going to be online soon, and we'll ask Milton about that. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about Shakespeare. You may have heard about this report from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, in which they ask, if reading Shakespeare is not central to a liberal education, what is? A degree in English without Shakespeare is like an MD without a course in anatomy. It is tantamount to fraud. We'll be talking about the report that shows that only 15 of the 70 colleges and universities it examined required English majors, can you believe this, English majors, to take a Shakespeare course. We'll talk about that the second hour of our program. Milton Coleman is our guest, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And we start with Christian from Racine. Hi, Christian. Hi, are you there? Hello? Hello? Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Jake in Milwaukee, actually.
Oh, okay.
I had a question concerning the more concerning the Don Imus situation. And often I saw in the news media that the white reporters talking about the situation would report what was going on, but not have a whole lot of emotional involvement in it, and they would defer to their African American colleagues for advice on more or less how to be impacted by it, how to be offended, saying that this is what happened. It doesn't really affect me as a person, as an American, as a member of the community, but how does it make you feel? How should I be impacted in my daily life? And I was a bit appalled by that because I think as a member of the community that this should in fact impact all of us and not necessarily be deferred to the people the comments were directed against.
Milton.
Well, I think I agree with the caller in the sense that there should be some offense felt by other than those directly involved. But I think there was. I think that many women's groups spoke up, and true, the people who were the target of his words were young women, but they were young black women, and I think other people were offended as well, because I think people tend to look at words can hurt an awful lot, and people want to live in a certain kind of society, and I think there were many people who were not young black women, many people who were not women, many people who were not black, who felt offended that such words could be used to describe such women. So I think probably what the reporters may have been, the non-black reporters or non-reporters who were not reporters of color, may have been asking these people is to try to get a sense not only of what you feel as a journalist, but what you might feel as an individual. We all we're taught to try to keep our personal feelings out of things, but that doesn't mean that someone could not be offended. I have a granddaughter who's going to be 13 who plays for her school's basketball team. And if those words were directed at my granddaughter, I'd certainly feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in fact, I'd want to hold up those women who are going to college, who have achieved almost the ultimate. They almost won the championship. I would want to say to my granddaughter, look, you can be like them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Linda from Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning.
I have a comment and a question. Last night, Bill Moyers interviewed a number of media personnel in the way that President Bush controlled the conversation to make it look like Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which later turned out to be a lie. Now, it's a series of programs on how President Bush manipulated the media, and since he lied about why we should invade Iraq, and since he's still president, along with his vice president, why should we believe him now? Now, I believe this would be a good chance, if our government really cared to look into this, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney should be impeached. And will they? And then I have a follow-up.
All right, Milton, take it on.
I have no idea whether they will be impeached. That's news we have to report on. I understand from I've been on the road since Sunday, but I understand from watching CNN that Representative Kucinich has introduced a bill that would move in that direction. I guess regarding Vice President Cheney, but I have no idea whether they will be impeached.
Yeah. Are you going to watch the first debate tonight, the Democrats' debate tonight?
I'm actually going to not be able to do that because I'm in Eau Claire for a program at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, honoring a deceased colleague, Ann Devroy, who passed about 11 years ago. She was one of the greatest White House reporters in the history of the Washington Post. And in her memory, her family and the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and the Washington Post established the Ann Devroy Fellowship and the Ann Devroy Lecture, and tonight at the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire is going to be the 10th anniversary Ann Devroy Forum. That's where I'll be.
Linda, thanks very much for the call. What do you think? This thought of not being able to get my newspaper has been staying with me ever since Dirk Halstead said this yesterday. What do you think about newspapers not being around, Milton, 4 or 5 years from now? Is it all going to be online?
No, it's not all going to be online. Newspapers will be around. Newspapers will be very different than we see them now because online has made a very, very significant impact upon this business. And all of us who are forward-looking are reorganizing ourselves and thinking of ourselves in a different way as what we first and foremost are, which are news organizations that present that news on a number of platforms. And you'll find a much more robust online news operation 5 years from now. You'll find newspapers still around. Each newspaper will have to define what its audience is. We probably will not be the major vehicle for breaking news, but we will still have the ability to analyze, to do enterprise, to break enterprise news. We'll come up with the news on our own. We will still have the ability to aggregate, and we will still have the power of the written word and the power of the still photograph. It's just that the way that news organizations such as the Washington Post present that news already is changing, has changed, and will continue to change, and you will get your news in many, many different ways. People don't sit down with the newspaper in the morning anymore and say, this is the major way I'm going to get news. They get a little bit here, they get a little bit there, from this, from that, and that trend will continue.
Yeah, but it's this not being able to sit down in the morning with your newspaper. I must be getting real old.
You will be able to sit down in the morning with your news, with your newspaper. Just get home delivery from the Journal Sentinel. And my friend Marty Kaiser will be happy.
So they're still going to be around.
Yes,
the local papers will still be around.
Yes, especially the local papers. Huh. Although most newspapers indeed are local. There's only about 4 or 5 national newspapers. We're not one of them, by the way. Most of our 95% of our circulation is within 50 miles of Washington, D.C. The national newspapers are like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today. We're not a national newspaper. Your local newspaper, the Journal Sentinel, is still going to be around. The Capital Times and all the papers in Madison are going to still be around.
Yeah. Thanks, Milton, so much for being with us, and congratulations again on your award.
Thank you very much, and have a very good day.
Thanks. Milton Coleman, Deputy Managing Editor of the Washington Post, who's going to be receiving on Saturday of this week the Sacred Cat Award given by the Milwaukee Press Club at the Gridiron Dinner. He has been at the Post for a number of years, since 1976, when he was a reporter on the Metropolitan staff. He's been city editor. He was moved to the national news staff in 84, covered the presidential campaign, Congress, state and local governments, and he now helps direct coverage of the paper. He grew up in Milwaukee, went to Milwaukee Public Schools, and received a scholarship. And this is the turning point in his life, he said, to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I don't know what I would have done, he says, without that scholarship, which, if I remember correctly, was $128 a semester, which, when all was said and done, was my ticket to ride. It was like a handshake to me saying that I could be, that I am, not could be, I am a scholar. We thank him so much for being with us. We're going to continue our conversation this Thursday morning and welcome more of your phone calls, switching more attention now to the vote which came last night in the U.S. House of Representatives, the House brushing aside a veto threat and passing legislation that would, it's in a non-binding fashion, but would order the president to begin withdrawing troops from Iraq by the 1st of October. The Senate is looking at this right now. It's a 218-208 vote, and the passage puts the bill on track to clear Congress by tomorrow and to arrive on the desk of the president in coming days as the first binding congressional challenge to the president's handling of the conflict, which is now in its fifth year. This part of the program, we're going to be speaking with Professor Christopher Schrader, who's Charles S. Murphy Professor of Law and Professor of Public Policy Studies at Duke University, Director of the Program in Public Law there. He has served as Acting Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice, where he was responsible for legal advice to the Attorney General, the Executive Office of the President, and other executive branch agencies on a broad range of issues, including separation of powers, other constitutional issues, and matters of statutory interpretation and administrative law. He also served as Chief Counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Congress and the White House, of course, locked now in a high-stakes game over the war in Iraq. It's been described as a chicken game. And we'll be looking at what the Constitution has to say about this, what authority the president has when it comes to war, what authority the Congress has when it comes to war, and how all of this is playing out right now in this very large debate over this very controversial war. So continue calling us if you'd like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you are in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Christopher Schrader, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be with you.
What do you think of the House vote?
Well, I think it was predictable. The House is an institution where the majority can get done what it wants to get done when it has a unified mind about it. And clearly, the Democrats believe they were given a mandate at the last election to try to do something to change the course of the war, and this is the latest step they're trying to take.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a non-binding. The troop withdrawal is non-binding. Why wouldn't the Democrats have gone for a binding resolution, really put some teeth in it?
Well, I think they believe at this point they have great difficulty in getting that through the Senate. And that's the harder body in this kind of situation to move a piece of legislation like this. There's a very narrow 51-49 majority in the Senate, but before you can get to a majority vote, you have to overcome the prospect of a filibuster, and that requires 60 votes. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't much prospect that a binding resolution could get the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster.
Mm-hmm. So the president gets this legislation, which the Senate will probably pass today, next week. He vetoes it. Then what?
Well, both the House and the Senate leaders are trying to figure out what their next step is. I've heard some proposals that they will pass what the president calls a clean bill, but with a short time period, say a month or 6 months. I mean, 2 months or to 6 months are the range that I've heard, to provide the necessary funding for the troops, which everyone in Congress wants to give. No one is arguing that the funding for the troops should be cut off. So that may well be what we see next, a short-term funding supplemental bill that would then allow the political back and forth between the White House and the Congress over the exit strategy to continue, but would make sure the troops are being funded.
Yeah. Does Congress, Professor Schrader, have the right constitutionally to ask for accountability?
I certainly believe they do. You could talk to others who would disagree, but I think the Constitution is actually quite clear on a couple of things. One, the president is clearly the commander-in-chief. He's the operational manager of any armed conflict we get into. But two, the Congress is really at least an equal decision-maker, if not more than equal, on deciding when we get into a war, how big a war it's going to be, and when we get out. And to make those decisions, the military and the president as commander-in-chief have to supply the information to Congress that it needs to make an assessment, and then Congress gets to make that assessment about whether this is a conflict that we ought to be in or not.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that Congress has been fairly thoroughly informed here?
Well, yes and no. I think we did go through a period of time in which the oversight responsibilities of Congress and both the House and the Senate were not being met as fully as they might. There was a fair amount of willingness to let the president take the lead and make his judgments and not second-guess them. But I think that changed remarkably in November with the message that was sent during the elections. And I now think you're seeing in many of the House and the Senate committees good, serious efforts being made by the members to make sure they're up to speed and knowledgeable about what's going on over there.
Great. And let's talk a little bit more about the American public's statement with the midterms last year. What do you think we're saying, and where do we figure into all of this?
Well, I think there's a great deal of disquiet about the prospects for any kind of definitive resolution to the situation in Iraq, and a belief by most Americans that Iraq is essentially in a civil war now, and it is going to have to go through and experience a period of unsettlement and internal discord and a good deal of violence. But that's going to happen whether we leave today or whether we leave 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, if I'm reading the attitude of my fellow citizens correctly, it's sort of the notion that we can't see a way to do in the short term or any manageable period of time in which major American troops could be there a transformation of Iraq itself that would be so significant and successful that the kind of disintegration of the country that seems to be on the horizon could be prevented.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, we shouldn't be sacrificing American lives over a period of time in which, at the end of the day, the situation is not going to be improved very much.
Right. And so how does Congress determine, and how do we factor into that determination, what the end of the day is? Is it we give it till August to see how the surge is doing? Is it that we just feel very uncomfortable about withdrawing money because we wouldn't then be supporting the troops? I'm wondering what the end of this might be.
Yeah. I think that, as a practical matter, what we're going to see is Congress waiting until late in the summer, early fall, when General Petraeus has to give an accounting of whether the surge has been successful. There's been, I think people in the Congress on both sides of the aisle have a great deal of respect for the ability of the military leaders and commanders to figure out what is going on and to be realistic about it. So I think they're expecting that by the end of the summer, Petraeus will give them a report that will enable them to see whether or not he believes that there's something in the way of substantial progress being made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to be end up going through the summer without really a resolution of the standoff between the president and the Congress, but with lots of efforts on both sides to put pressure on the other branch to see things more its way.
Yeah. And the Congress really does have the money power here, right? You said at some point that the president doesn't have the authority to go into the U.S. Treasury on his own and cut a big check and send it over to the troops.
Well, that's right. The Constitution's quite clear about that. It gives the Congress, not the president, the power to raise and support the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. And in fact, it requires that the Congress consider whether more money should be appropriated at least every 2 years, if not more often. So it was a conscious decision in drafting the document that at least every 2 years, if not more often, Congress would have to make its own decision as to whether the conflict we were in was something that it wanted to continue to see the troops be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And the funding authority is not really an authority that was designed to leave the troops without financial support.
Mm-hmm.
It was the way the framers, the tool the framers gave the Congress to be able to control how long we stayed involved in a conflict that we had gotten involved in.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way for Congress, other than the purse strings here, to say when the president wanted more troops to go over, clearly the American public did not want that to happen. They were not in favor of a surge. Is the purse string the only thing that's available to Congress to say, wait a second, we don't want you to go this way. We don't want more troops.
No, they could just pass a straight bill. And, in fact, in the funding package that's being debated now, the conference report on the supplemental appropriations, they're not actually using the power of the purse to cut off funds to the troops. The provisions that are in there now are simply directions to the president to make certain determinations about whether benchmarks have been satisfied or not. And the legislation then simply provides that on one of two dates, depending on whether the determination has been made or not, redeployment should begin. So there's never a use of the kind of standard language that you can see in funding bills of no funds from this appropriation shall be used to support the troops in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They could start, you could, as a matter of legislative process, just separate the provisions that are getting so much debate, these benchmark provisions and the you have to begin redeployment by this date provision, put it in a separate piece of legislation and debate that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the supplemental, because it's something that everybody knows has to be passed,
I see,
is the vehicle that's being used to deliberate on this issue.
Yeah. And what about the surge? Are all the forces there now?
I don't believe they are all there, but we're very close. That my latest recollection, which I think is 2 or 3 weeks old.
Uh-huh.
It takes a while, of course, as you know, to actually prepare and outfit 25,000, which really becomes something like 40,000 when you count the support that has to go on behind the lines and get them over there. There is also a provision in this supplemental that would require any additional troops that get sent to Iraq to be fully mission capable, which some of them, we've heard reports that some of the units going over at this point being more or less trained on the run and would not satisfy that definition. So that might slow down additional forces. But I think by the time that provision became law, if it ever did, the surge would have been fully staffed, so it wouldn't really have an effect.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Christopher Schrader, and we'll do that in just one moment. We're talking about the House vote late last night concerning funding. $124.2 billion war funding bill that would require troop withdrawals to begin October 1st with the goal of completing the pullout 6 months later. And the Senate will be taking this up. They're debating it as we speak. Of course, you know the president has promised to veto this bill. We're looking at the power of the presidency, the power of the Congress when it comes to conducting war, and also looking at this particular legislation and trying to factor into what the American people thinks should be done in this. We're welcoming phone calls, and we have time to take your phone call right now. As a matter of fact, we have all our phone lines open, so jump right in. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We're having a spring pledge drive that starts on the 3rd of May. And if you'd like to pledge online before we start the drive, that would shorten it. Members have contributed over $9,000 toward our goal of $275,000. We will end the drive once we reach the goal. And if we reach it before May 3rd, then you don't even have to have a drive. How's that? Pledge online, WPR.org, WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with the president of the American Council of Trustees and alumni on the report issued this week on what is believed to be William Shakespeare's birthday, The Vanishing Shakespeare. We'll also speak with a professor emeritus of English at the University of Illinois who has taught many courses on Shakespeare. This report showed that of the 70 colleges and universities they examined, only 15 require their English majors, we're talking English majors here, to take a Shakespeare course. Why? All right, that's the second hour of our program. Let's welcome your phone calls now. Full bank of phone lines, 800-486-8655 is our number. Michael from Platteville, hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very interested that the professor is talking about the purse strings limitations against control of the military that was in the founding documents. But I thought it was also timely to, I'd like him to finish that conversation. Am I wrong in assuming that that was also linked to the Second Amendment and that the original intent of the Second Amendment was so that those muskets could be at the ready for that two-year request for funding and not for personal armaments?
But it is a whole different topic if you want to comment on it.
Sure. The relationship between what the Constitution refers to as the Army and what it refers to as the militia is really quite an interesting one, and one I think we've sort of lost in the march of history. The framers did have a conception that the first line of support of defense for the country would actually be the militia, which were defined as units of ordinary citizens who had the right to bear arms and would be prepared to defend the country in the event of an invasion. It was only if a conflict became so large, or if we decided sort of from a standing start that we wanted to initiate a conflict, that the framers thought that the Congress would have to raise an army, which would be a federally funded, federally instituted organization. They didn't think we would have a standing army at all. They didn't preclude it in so many terms, but they didn't think they would have it. So there was definitely a founding conception of the militia as a well-armed group of individuals who were capable of defending the country in times of invasion. Now, the current debate over the Second Amendment concerns whether that's the limit to the notion of the protection of our right to bear arms, and that is to say it's limited to allowing people to be prepared to act as militia for a governmental organization, or if it's also an individual right that provides that any American who wishes has the right to bear arms, possess arms, whether or not it's associated with militia training. That's a debate that we've been undertaking for decades, really, in this country. And I must say the history of the Second Amendment is just very murky on this subject, mm-hmm. as to which of those views is the correct one.
Yeah, let's save further discussion this for another show. We got our hands full with Iraq today, too. Terry from Bayside, hi.
Oh, hi. My comment has to do with an issue which I think has not been brought into the foreground, and that is this. That while the Bush administration talks about a political solution, apparently what they have in mind is to leave it up to a Shiite-dominated parliament to increase the oil revenues to the Sunnis and therefore make them happy. Unfortunately, that's not a central issue when you get sectarian violence. If the Bush administration had anybody in the administration with any creativity, they would have seen long enough ago that what was needed in the country was some outside mediation group that could effect some sort of truth and reconciliation process, such as was done in South Africa. South Africa avoided a civil war because they set up a commission that could honestly deal with the differences of the various sects. There's no such attempt by the Bush administration. Instead, we have the idea of a wall, which is a derivative of the Israeli wall and is bound to be hated by both the Sunnis and the Shiites. An international commission, which was dedicated to a true reconciliation process, that would work on that would be a much more sensible thing to do before we attempt some sort of closure to the Iraq situation. We should at least give them a chance to have an opportunity for some sensible mediation.
Okay. Professor Schrader.
Well, I think the caller makes a good point. I think one of the reasons that many Americans are so frustrated with where we are now as we can look back at earlier points in this engagement and say, if only we had done something different back then, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now. Unfortunately, we are in the situation we're in now, and matters have come to such a point that a Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the sort that worked in South Africa at this point, I think, just doesn't have the ability to get off the ground until you've established some competent and effective government, which is then capable of mediating between the warring sides. And the difficulty in Iraq at the moment is there isn't an effective government to do that. It may require a regional involvement by the neighboring states, which is something that I think Secretary Rice has been exploring in a very tentative way, but that's also a very difficult kind of solution to manage because the neighboring states are so much at odds over what the ultimate outcome should be. Iran is obviously Shiite-dominated and would prefer a Shiite-dominated solution, and Saudi Arabia sits on the other side and thinks oppositely. It's a very hard situation for the president to manage, and I can understand why he is having such a great difficulty explaining what an exit strategy should be, because there aren't good choices. There are only efforts to try to come up with the least bad choices.
Right. Do you imagine that he has some kind of strategy here, and he ought to tell us about it, or does he consider that his presidential authority allows him to just to conduct this war in the fashion he sees fit?
Well, he's got a hope, but I'm not sure he's got a strategy that's going to work to get there. The idea, the surge is the strategy, and the idea behind it is that you can create enough civil order in Baghdad to permit the government, the Iraqis themselves, to train up their security forces enough to be loyal to that government, who can then maintain order going forward at least the minimal level that's necessary for the central government to have some effect over what's happening in the country. The problem that many military analysts who've spoken about this have is they think, although in theory the idea of establishing security and a functioning government in Baghdad is the right end state, it would take many thousands more American troops than the 20,000 or so in the surge
mm-hmm.
to accomplish that over a longer period of time than I think the president has to make this decision. I think Petraeus had it exactly right when a couple of days ago he gave a press conference, and one of his remarks was, the clock in Baghdad is running a lot slower than the clock in the United States.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Dave from Lakewood next. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just a couple of comments. One thing about the people that complain about why we're in Iraq and everything, apparently most of them weren't born long enough ago to remember the 1930s. Also, this big rush as to why we haven't settled this whole thing in Iraq yet. Do you remember that we were 20 years in Germany after World War II before things got settled down over there? And also, as far as the troop withdrawal goes, apparently what the Democrats want us to do is to make up a war plan, and then we should submit it to the insurgents and al-Qaeda and let them know exactly what we're going to do, which to me is meddling, and it's pure politics and nothing else.
Professor Schrader.
Well, I think the analogy to post-World War II occupation in Germany is a little bit off in the sense that the level of conflict, actual shooting violence that was occurring after the Second World War, was minuscule compared to what we're involved in Iraq. So the military faces quite a different set of decisions, and the American people face a different set of decisions about how long we want our men and women to be in harm's way. And the other difference is that after World War II, we were trying to stabilize or maintain a fragile stability that had been established between the East and the West. And so you were working on maintaining the equilibrium. In Iraq, there is no equilibrium. We're trying to create the equilibrium with a force size, a troop commitment that I think a lot of people think is actually insufficient to accomplish that goal. And yet we're continuing to suffer casualties and losses in the face of a very pessimistic prediction about what the Iraqi internal political system is going to be able to do to maintain that stability.
Yeah. Oh, it's really a mess, isn't it?
There's no happy ways out, I think.
No.
One of the difficulties that both of the main protagonists in this dispute, the Congress and the President, are having right now. I think there are lots of people in Congress on both sides of the aisle who appreciate how difficult this situation is, but they have different views. They disagree with the President over that question of what's the least worst thing to do at this point.
Yeah. Professor Schrader, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Professor Christopher Schrader, he's Charles S. Murphy Professor of Law and Public Policy Studies at Duke University, and we thank him so much for joining us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We also want to thank Milton Coleman for joining us the first half hour of the program. Milton, Deputy Managing Editor of the Washington Post in Milwaukee, to receive the Sacred Cat Award from the Milwaukee Press Club this Saturday. Thanks for listening and for your calls, everybody. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Thursday morning conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.